Good morning. Can you hear me okay? Are these on? Yes. But I don't know if we'll need them anyway. First, I need to announce it is 10 a.m. on Tuesday, April 11th, and this panel is named At-Risk Kids, Breaking the Cycle. We're sorry, one of our speakers, Grimm, was unable to make it to the conference. And so we've called local people, which we don't usually do, to come and be with us. But in our case,
the mic is on. Just talk into the mic.
You have to get close.
Get really close. Yeah. Lips on it. Okay. All right there. It is 10 o'clock a.m. on Tuesday, April 11th. And this panel is on at-risk kids breaking the cycle. So unfortunately, we lost one of our panelists this week. He was unable to come, Grimm. In our case, we're very fortunate to have Dr. Rodriguez come in his place. I know that you've all read everyone's bios, but because Eddie is an add-on, I am going to do my best to read this very, very small font.
Louder.
It's not on. Should I go to the other side to see if that one works?
Yeah, I use this one.
That's fine.
I'm going to move to the one on the end. See how that works.
This one's not on.
How's this?
Tap your mic.
Can you hear me?
Yes.
Hello. Yeah. Okay, and I'll hand it back to you. Okay, so do you want me to start again with what I said?
No?
Okay, please don't. Okay, so we have Eddie with us today, who I am on the board of Amistad with, and we have some Amistad members here. And let me read to you about Eddie. He completed his doctorate in the field of education equity and cultural and diversity at the University of Colorado at Boulder. His research interest is the study of emergent bilingual students' biliteracy trajectories. Currently, he is the English language development and biliteracy director for Adams 14 in Commerce City, Colorado, a very, very low income school. Do I have both now?
Yes.
His main role is to design, implement, and evaluate K-12 educational programs that have the purpose to ensure equal opportunities for minority students to develop their academic linguistic competencies in both English and Spanish. He believes that equity in education and in the U.S. and the world is critical to promote meaningful learning environments that guarantee the social, emotional, economic advancement of minorities and marginalized populations. Okay? So that's the bio. And let me just explain to you how this works when it's a duet. It allows for me to be a bit more involved and provocative because we have just three of us. We, in Atlas, do not have internet service, so you cannot ask your questions over the app, which is what we prefer. So we'll hand out now note cards to all of you for questions. And I have a few fun facts as we get started. And I had the privilege of watching James Bell speak yesterday, and he is on it. But I think it would be fun to let you know that he was one of the first students or first young adults to dance on Soul Train. So keep that one in your back pocket for later. And Eddie brews his own beer and would like to open a brew pub at some point in his home, Veracruz, Mexico. So why don't you start?
Okay.
And there you go.
Good morning, everybody. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks for coming.
From the time our children are born, we aspire to have them grow up in a loving environment with opportunities for education and play that keep them happy and healthy. As a society, we have an obligation to enhance nurturing and provide supports so that children are able to reach their maximum potential, regardless of skin color, gender, sexual orientation, income, or ability. In the recent Oscar-winning film, Moonlight, the central character, Chiron, endeavors to negotiate sexual identity, fear of bullying, trauma, and lack of parental supervision as best he can. All of the usual risk factors in most modalities today for young people considered at risk. The film depicts the claustrophobia and scarcity of options and resources in neighborhoods of concentrated and persistent poverty. In this case, in the film, Liberty City and Overtown in Miami-Dade County. While enduring months of adversity with no services available to him that he is aware of, Chiron takes safety into his own hands by violently attacking his major nemesis in the classroom, breaking a chair across his back. In the theater I attended, the attack was greeted with what felt like to me cathartic applause. Like, yeah, the little guy fights back. You know, don't let him punk you, Chiron. Punish that bully and teach him a lesson, you could feel in the applause. So many emotions that were wrapped up in that applause. A testament, actually, to the power of great art. However, I wasn't clapping. I thought the applause missed that Chiron won the battle, but he lost the war for the type of wellness services he deserved and would have gotten had he lived in neighboring Coral Gables, Florida, rather than in Liberty City. Instead, he was arrested, traversed the youth justice apparatus. He was sent out of state, where he becomes a drug dealer, never able to address his sexual identity or trauma, and worse than that, he's on parole. Inequities by race and ethnicity for the purposes of this gathering are deeply rooted and part of a structural fabric woven almost imperceptibly, but deliberately by policies and practices that are born of discrimination. The impact on the psyche and the soul of negotiating the mores and dictates in too many communities requires a sophisticated and culturally wise analysis to make communities healthier in the face of income inequality and deeper marginalization evident in almost every walk of life in those places. And we'll hear from Edilberto, who will talk about the stresses that he's dealing with in trying to keep a school afloat in a neighborhood that is mostly Latino. And it is not unusual for people in neighborhoods of concentrated and persistent poverty, people of color mostly, to live in communities to experience depression or self-medicate themselves with alcohol or drugs. I would venture to say that some of you guys here may not live in those places, but you have your coping mechanisms as well. And some of you call it Chardonnay. Some of you call it Sauvignon Blanc. I call it Haagen-Dazs. But rarely for these youth are there options in their communities for evaluation and treatment. And as a result, too often, they end up in the justice apparatus. What we need to do, I believe, is redefine how risk is used in the helping professions. The term itself and the industry it generates already stacks the decks against many of the people it is trying to serve. At risk, why not at promise, at hope, at strength? It is gatherings like this that we must set the agenda for the rest of this century. We must use our abilities and authority to articulate the humanity in young people that are being dispossessed merely because of who they are. If you look at Freddie Gray's neighborhood, where tensions boiled over in Baltimore into destruction and just uprising against conditions, that's a neighborhood that had 60% unemployment, which if you walk around the waterfront in Baltimore, you'd never see it, you'd never know it. Lead paint, 8% kids in those kinds of things. So think about your coping mechanisms every day in that kind of environment. So many of you here sitting in this room know exactly what I'm talking about, that when you positively impact youth and families, you can see it in their eyes. There is a power that is unleashed, and it instills and restores the kind of agency that many of us walk in the room with that they've never had, their own agency to be able to solve their own problems. Positive youth development, as envisioned here, would have you striving to provide the tools for young people to participate in positive, autonomous decision making. It consists of giving young people the tools to be motivated from within, as we are, promoting qualities such as creativity, leadership, altruism, and civic engagement. Communities are not only neighborhoods, blocks, meets and bounds. Communities are shared interests and shared responses to objective conditions. We need to encourage the idea of community, of belonging, of language, of identity. All communities should be valued, and community values should be given great deference by anyone providing services in those communities. Providers should be more humble than they usually are. We must forge new relationships with community groups, relatives, caring adults, and youth-serving organizations. I posit to you that this is one of the only true ways to unpack the ubiquity and hegemony of gangs in some of our neighborhoods, is alternative relationships so that the gangs are not so attractive. Then as now, we do not need endless bucks to address the needs of communities, but we do need decision makers to be strategic, smart, and well-considered, to mandate and incentivize qualitative interventions that go beyond the mere processing of people that results in checking boxes and moving files, that seeks to develop partnerships with non-traditional organizations and share power to meet the challenges of the needs of those children who should be at promise.
I think it's important to note, it's not in Mr. Bell's bio, is that now he's in San Francisco running the Hayward Burns Institute. He was the founder of that. But he's dealing with equity in youth in the youth justice sector. Dr. Rodriguez?
Okay. Very nice. I think that the only way for us to really change the reality of our students, I think the only way for us to really change the reality of our youth at risk or is to truly understand our community, especially particularly for our minority students who are coming to our school system knowing two languages. And that is to understand the bilingual identity that they bring to the schools and to really appreciate the linguistic and cultural diversity. I think only then, when we truly understand what bilingualism and bilingual development truly means for us, for our community, and for this country, we can really change the reality for our students. As Rolly mentioned, I'm currently in the ELD, English Language Development, and bilingual director for ANS 14 school district, where we serve 7,000 students K to 12. 85% are Latino and 50% are language learners. So my paramount responsibility is to design and to develop and implement and evaluate these language programs that will provide the best educational services for these students to not only master English proficiency, to meet academic standards, but also to continue developing their literacy skills in the native language, in this case Spanish, to continue developing that bilingual and biliteracy identity that is part of who they are. Unfortunately, there is a very important quote from one of the researchers that says that when a child comes to our school learning two languages or knowing two languages, and when they leave the school system only learning English, we have done a disservice to population, because now they are less than who they were when they came to our classrooms. So part of my job is to make sure that every individual in IELTS 14 continues on that trajectory, not only masters in English, but also to develop the literacy identity. And also, we're moving forward pretty soon in the next 2 years. Now, it's not only for these emerging bilingual students, but also for any English speaker or any speaker of any other language who are interested in becoming bilingual by the time they graduate from the high school. So I think my only important comment is to really let's understand our reality, let's understand our population, our youth population that comes to our classrooms, so we can really transform the realities.
What is the graduation rate of your school?
Right now we have 63% graduation rate at the high school. So we are for the last 5 years we haven't seen any achievement in the school district for the last 5 years. We see a flat line. Yes? Okay. So right now we are working with the state to submit a turnaround plan. We're going to be proposing new strategies, new ways of doing to improve the academic experience of our students at the state level. Otherwise, we could have potentially the district could be closed, it could become a charter school, or could be taken by a different school district.
Are people filling out note cards?
We didn't get them.
Okay, so let's make sure those are passed around. Please put your name on them so I can call you out as well. Mr. Bell, are you working all over San Francisco and the surrounding areas?
So our work is for children that are served by public agencies all over the country. We've been in over 200 counties in 23 states in the U.S. So most of those places have been urban, rural, and suburban. So we have a wealth of experience from New York City to Spokane, Washington, in terms of our experience.
And many have been incarcerated?
So what we find is that many of you may know this axiom that if you give me your zip code, I can give you your life expectancy. This is what research is beginning to find out. There's a interesting, they told us not to do PowerPoints. I usually like to show this slide. There's an interesting place in Kansas, two cities. I forget, one is Blue Hills and the other one is some other name, but they both have hills in them. And they're 6 miles apart down the interstate. And in one neighborhood, the average lifespan is 69 years of age. And 6 miles up the road, it's 83. And so that didn't just happen because there were a few street signs. There's reasons that this occurs. So when we say that we are working in the justice sector, when children who are at risk do not fulfill whatever the agency is, and many of the agencies actually try to move these young people along, eventually they will end up in the justice system. So if you have ADD or if you have other kinds of things that are happening that Dr. Rodriguez is dealing with in his schools, at some point like Chiron, when that kid breaks a chair over somebody, law enforcement is called. When children have mental health issues and they can't sit still and they get violent, eventually they do come to the justice sector, unless you have the kind of money and resources to actually keep them out. And most youth court judges, if parents come in with money to say, Your Honor, we'll get them a therapist, we'll get them a this, we'll get them a that, judges like, go with God, thank you, get them out of here, because I got way too many that don't have that. So we deal with justice as a result of other public systems not being able to serve the young people that are at risk that come to them.
I'm assuming you see that in your schools?
Well, that's not part of my responsibilities to deal with the when students, there is truancy or there is any type of those behaviors. But I believe that part of my job is to make sure that students are engaged through effective educational programs. So they don't get to that point by middle school and high school, because right now what we see is there's a high rate of disengagement for our minority students, especially in us 14 in Commerce City. We have this program that we are mandated by federal guidelines to establish, which is the English Language Development Program. And this is for students who speak any other language than English. And the kids, they call it English Language Detention. So there is no engagement right now at the middle school and high school after fifth grade. So what do we do with a child who is not engaged for 55 minutes, 180 days in the school year? How much instruction we are losing, and how much part of the academic they are really not taking advantage of, or we are not really, truly, I take the responsibility, we are not providing to these students. 5 years ago, the district decided to go to an English-only program, and now we see students in middle school, high school, with a reading ability of third, fourth, or fifth grade. How do we expect students to graduate at that rate? When there is a lot of research that continues suggesting that educating students in a native language in the early years of schooling is the most effective way to engage and to educate all minority students. And we as institutions, we as a federal, as a state agency, we continue ignoring years of research that provide the guidance to best educate these students. So even though I'm not dealing with that, we're trying to prevent the students to get to that point of disengagement and to drop out.
So a curious thing happened in Boulder, Colorado, and I was on the board and the committee to help put forth on the ballot preschool for all children. And successfully that was passed. But then after a few years, we realized that there weren't the outcomes we had hoped for. And so we put, you know, We spent a lot of time educating family members that then went door to door and talked to their neighbors about the need for parent engagement, that it can't just be sending your child to school earlier or summer program. There has to be another level of engagement. We're still seeing if that will be effective. So my question to you is, do you see improvements with preschool education for all?
Well, right now, the way we offer preschool, as you may know, is through special funding through the state. But in order for you to qualify for preschool, is you have to experience risk factors, at least three. That could be a socioeconomic status. That could be, and one of those is language. So if you speak any other language than English, that's a risk factor according to the state, and therefore you qualify for preschool. So it will take a very well knowledgeable school leader to reframe that risk factor in terms of students having a any other language than the English, to make a positive experience for our population. Now, answering to your question, yes, we see students are very, because another thing that we have in AS 14 is that all the preschool teachers that are super highly qualified. Mm-hmm. Every preschool teacher has a master's degree, it has a special ed endorsement. So what we see is the students, they have tremendous academic growth for 2 years in the preschool, but we see that when they reach kindergarten, that achievement decreases. So we're trying to figure out what's happening in the kindergarten, and we believe is when we combine really strong students and academically with new students to the kindergarten who didn't receive the preschool, probably we are lowering the standards and not increasing the rigor, the academic rigor for all the students. But we're trying to figure out why that is. But thus far, we have seen it's very effective to have a preschool for a population.
I don't want to speak to that specifically. It's not my expertise. But I do want to speak to your point, Robin, about parent engagement. So many, not only in the schools, but in the mental health and health areas, certainly for those young people that are in trouble with the law, it's social workers, court workers, it's a automatic impulse to blame the parents. It's like the parents are not doing their job or whatever. We used to hear, they sat on every bar stool in the county, why don't they raise their kids? You know, and so I think parent engagement is something that we should look at in terms of how we approach it. Because in terms of children at risk, and this thing, is there's an assumption that those parents don't love their kids. And I think that would not be the case. The question is, are we asking parents to be super people? Are they the one that has to work 3 jobs, then be a good parent at the PTA, then be the one doing homework, then be the one that goes out of the neighborhood to get good food, and, you know, not microwave the pizza at 10 o'clock at night and call that dinner? I mean, how are we asking people to overcome such odds? And so I think it's incumbent for systems people and people with resources. What we know is that any of us that need help need an ambassador to us to make that help okay. Nobody just got up and said, I'm going to run a marathon and start running 26 miles. This is the United States. We don't do anything without a trainer or gear. First thing we do is get gear, then we get somebody to help us. And so now we need those ambassadors for parents. And I think the programs that have been successful have done that. I'll give you one example, then we can get to the questions. In Garfield High School in Los Angeles, 99.9% Latino was the subject of a film about math in the East LA Latino community. The principal decided that most of the discipline and suspensions were for what is called willful defiance. And willful defiance is a catch-all category that every teacher wants for when a teenager does something that they think is willful and defiant, but not exactly a violation of anything, which is, if you have teenagers' knows, is about 85% of their day, right? Rolling their eyes, sucking their teeth, you know, whatever teenagers are doing now to be willfully defiant. And 70% of the kids were being suspended for that. The principal said, we will no longer suspend for willful defiance. The teachers were apoplectic, like, you cannot take this tool away from us because we will lose the classroom. But what he did is, over a 3-year period, he said, 3 years hence, this will not be a tool that you can use anymore. So the first thing he did was establish relationships with community members. He paid abuelas to come into the school, to walk the halls, grandmothers, to relate to the community, so that when you began to have behavior problems in school, you would go speak to Consuelo or somebody that you could talk to like in the old days, about this behavior. And the teachers began to use that. So what I'm just giving is an example of, you can't just say, we need parent engagement. You must have ambassadors and a strategy and resource people in order to make it happen.
In a school here, I served as an advocate for a group of students, and a father came in talking about, or the administration wanted to talk to him about his son being disrespectful in the classroom. And as they went on, you could tell that the father didn't know how to advocate for his son, loving him so much and not really understanding. And I just said, he has ADD, I'm pretty sure. And then all of the administrators say, they were, yes, yes, yes. Why aren't we talking about services for that? We don't have the money. So they didn't even like address that because they didn't know how they could. But then that kind of advocacy, well, let's find some people in the school that actually would help pay for that. And, you know, that's when there's both income levels together that you can do something like that. But it must just be incredibly complicated to be in a school in which there isn't that type of ability. So I cannot believe this. We will do our best, okay? So I think I'm going to turn them upside down because this means this is the first question. But that's not the case. I'll find the one that came in first. The former U.S. Secretary of Education, Duncan, said students know what's working and what's not working in schools before anyone else. How can the student voice be used to improve student engagement?
I'll try first.
Okay.
Look, that's something that we are lacking of, especially in my district. I'll be talking specifically about my local context. We don't hear our students' voice. And I can go back to this example about the ELD blog. In terms of equity and engaging our students and providing the best educational practices for students, just in terms of scheduling, the big difference that we can make for students. At the middle school level, we are deciding to put the ELD block as a core curriculum or as an elective. So 400 students, they can go either sacrifice an elective because they have to go to ELD. So they see that as an unfair practice for the school. Why me, who I am bilingual, I have two languages, I had to sacrifice an elective to take an ELD? Where we can put the ELD in the core wheel, and everybody gets to have two electives. So just as simple as how do we place the ELD block can make a difference in terms of student engagement. We have a survey, we have students saying this is an unfair practice, and we still probably continue providing the ELD block as an elective wheel. So there is no opportunities right now, there is no venues for students to provide a voice to have an input on what would be the best practices for them. So I think we are struggling, not only at Commerce City, but probably in a lot of school districts in the state of Colorado.
Mm-hmm. I would add to that I think there's a correlation between the need for student voice, and as you suggest, Robin, in your previous statement, and the more stressed your school is in terms of meeting the requirements that Dr. Rodriguez is talking about. Because as an administration, you cannot deliver what you need to deliver with the resources that they've given you without the students being there as a legitimate part, so that you are a team, that everyone's success is built together, because they want to succeed, you want them to succeed, and so how as a team can we be better with this lack of resources? And number one is to actually say that we deserve more resources and be a team about that. But the more that you, the administration and the students in schools that are increasingly in America highly segregated and highly under-resourced, The examples and research has shown that the schools that can survive that kind of resource deficit is where the administration, the teachers, and the students and the community work much better together.
I'm going to save this one because I think it will work itself out. What role can restorative justice play in improving outcomes?
So I'll start with that one. So if we look at the terms restorative justice, they're actually oxymoronic in a way, because justice is often viewed as retributive and punitive, and restorative is the total opposite of that. So right there, somebody's kind of bipolar to even try to get there and do that. So essentially, what we're talking about is what we've seen in the elite schools. If you want to see restorative justice at work, go to the country day school that the person is paying $25,000 a year to send their children to. They are not writing a check for zero tolerance policies. We're going to talk our way through this. Chad and Emily are going to figure it out, whereas Raheem and Daquan don't get a chance to do that at Denver's East High School, right? And so the question is, we know how to do it. The question is, who is it available for? And so what restorative justice tries to do is do what's happening every time. It did when I was in public school, when actually society hadn't disinvested in public schools. When there were two kids fighting, normal teenage behavior is about beefing with each other. I'm LeBron, you're Kobe. You know, I'm whatever, you're that. I mean, that's what, your girlfriend's ugly, my boyfriend's handsome, whatever. I mean, this is what teenagers do. I have a zit, my life is horrible now. I mean, that's normal adolescent activity. They are acting as they are supposed to. And so what we would do when we got in beef when we were in high school is somebody would say, pick you up, break you up, and this is what they would do. This is what is now called restorative justice. They would say, why are you fighting? And the why are you fighting is the same reason for 15 and 16-year-olds all over the world. They're both stupid, right? It's a stupid reason that matters to them, right? He said, she said, somebody said, I read on Facebook, right? It's very important to them. And then restorative justice was, apologize, work it out, let's keep it moving, because this is what happens. So restorative justice is just an attempt to basically, in schools that have gone zero tolerance, to basically have that thing of two people that got into a conflict that they're going to forget about in 2 weeks or not, to come together and try to resolve that. The problem is that it's a process. You have to have training on it now. And there, it's, you're trying to do something in an environment that's not restorative. So I would suggest that if you're going to do restorative justice, you do like Lincoln High did in Walla Walla, Washington. You have to have the infrastructure for restorative justice, meaning you have to create a culture for restorative justice in your school. You can't just put a program in and say, hey, guess what? Read the memo. We're now doing restorative justice. It has to be a fully integrated thing into the culture of your organization, and it's going to take you a while to implement. Most people just slap it on as a program, and that won't work.
No comment? Okay. We are running out of time a bit, and so I'm going to hope to get to as many of these questions as we can, and we'll be short so that we can get. Yeah.
Sorry.
So the benefits of literacy and content learning in one's home language is naturally segregating and therefore in direct conflict with our national values and goals of desegregation. How do we value and implement both goals? And this is from an English teacher.
That's a long question.
I know.
So, just try to see if I understood the question. So basically, there is a conflict or a tension between what students bring from their homes, from the home language, and the contradiction when they come to school in terms of the expectations. Is that correct? Is that it?
Cheryl?
Yeah. Eddie, this was in, I'm a former student actually of Eddie's, but I hear two different values. One is if we have students who speak Spanish at home learning only in English or perhaps giving them ELD, if we do that, that's a problem. So therefore, we should allow them to learn content in Spanish, let's say. This will naturally segregate students. Mr. Bell, I hear you saying that integration in schools is also what we all value. So they just seem in conflict with each other. I know it's a complex question, but...
But that's why you're here.
That's right. Well, yes. I mean, there is not any educational policy that really, truly acknowledges and supports any linguistic variation in a school system. Everything in the United States is from a monolingual approach, a standard English ideology, that English is the language that everybody needs to learn. And I think there is this where, again, we go back to understanding a population and having very educated policymakers, researchers, and school leaders to be able to ease that tension between what are the expectations to what students bring into our school system. We continue acknowledging that students' linguistic variation, cultural background is an asset for their academic proficiency. Because at the end, we want students to learn the English. But there are different processes, and there are different ways to get to that task or to that goal. And one is we immerse students in English only, which we know it doesn't work. Or we give the opportunities to develop two languages simultaneously because there are new approaches and there are new research that supports our new population, the new norm, which is an emerging bilingual student, who are these individuals who are growing up with two languages, who were born, since the first second they were born, they are listening to two languages. The nurse speaks English, says, "What a beautiful kid," and the mom says, "This is a mi hijo está muy hermoso." Since the first second of their life, the students are exposed to two languages. So there, I mean, everything comes down to ideology. And because, like I said before, we are totally ignoring years of research for bilingual development and bilingual programs and what is the best education for these students. So even though we're saying that students need to be in these programs for English language development, we also are providing or trying to provide other programs that continue developing the cultural background and the linguistic diversity, in this case, in Spanish. But again, it's ideology. Mostly we are dealing with ideology from a state level for policies and school leaders who still doesn't understand the nature of population. And I don't know if that I a little bit answered your question, but we continue, at least my department, we continue to acknowledging and supporting students' bilingual identities to be able to achieve the goal that is English competency. But there are different pathways for that. And we believe that continuing engaging students in developing the native language and cultural background is the best approach for us and for them.
Yeah, and I just want to add on quickly to that. This question that you raise about is there some tension there, we can run from that as long as we want, but people should leave this workshop understanding this statistic. 70%, over 70% of the people 25 or under in this country are people of color and may be speaking a different language. So you can run, but you cannot hide unless you all go to Vermont. But essentially, seriously, I mean, you can keep doing these enclaves, but we're going to have places like, Commerce City. And it's an economic fact. I'll just throw this out there as well. The research has shown, I live in an area where it's very technology rich. I live in San Francisco. And what we know is for every writer of a, quote, high income job that's writing a code for Google, they have three people who must work for them, who are doing three jobs. They have the dog walker, the nanny, or the house cleaner, and the Uber driver. And all three of those people that serve them might be coming from Commerce City, but have to live further and further away in order to get to them. And so even when you're enclaving, somebody has to do the work that you're paying this new economy to do. And so until we come up, we must face this fact that Dr. Rodriguez is talking about, because we cannot survive as a country just on the elites and what they can provide.
Okay, so I'm just going to give you a time check. It's 10:45. We will let you know when it's 10:50 so that you can go to your next panel if you have one. We have a few more minutes we could sit here, but then this will be occupied again at 11 for another session. Although we say that alternative relationships are important so that gangs aren't so attractive, many mm-hmm. kids have close family members mm-hmm. who are members, and the mm-hmm. gang culture is embedded in the mm-hmm. family structure. Mm-hmm. How can we reach these kids?
Yeah, thank you. That's a very good question. It's a very tough question. I think that you can only reach these young people as you can reach us. And that is by saying that alternative is not going to get you what you want. Because to the degree that it looks like it's going to get you what you want, then you will always lose that argument. Because teenagers think in the moment. And actually, if you think about a neighborhood that they live in, this is not a poor choice. People hate for me to say this, but sometimes not going to school is actually a decent choice based upon what you're going to experience when you go there. So it's not like these kids are like being, you know, unreasonable. Actually, given that situation, if you have to get on a bus and ride through three gang sets every day, each way to go to school, you may stay home and couch search too and watch Judge Judy, because you don't want that trauma and that stress on you every day because you can't jump in the Prius and be taken to class. So I think that in fact, what we have to do is not revile or make it such that gang involvement is a poor choice. We have to understand why that's the choice and see about how do we make better choices.
Here's a question from a student, and we always try to honor our students at Conference on World Affairs. How can we help, especially if we don't even know where to start?
Okay. I think you want to be an advocate for a population, like I said before. Let's understand who our population is and what do they bring into the realm of education. And try to advocate for equitable funding for schools. That we have the funds to really establish and design, implement the programs that we need. Another thing that has created this narrative for the famous achievement gap is the use of unfair, invalid, and unreliable assessments. So continue supporting that we get the funding to really design the best assessments to really assess to better instruct our students. So get to know our population and try to find ways to improve our funding for our schools.
We're at time. It looks like we may be able to go 5 minutes more. So. Okay. Then we're going to adjourn. Thank you all so much for being here.